Good morning, and welcome to today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for March 23rd, 2023. I'm your reader, Bob, and here is our first story. New era in Dubuque Air Service takes flight. After two-month delay, Avilo begins low-fare trips, by Kaylee Reese. As Dubuque Mayor Brad Kavanaugh spoke to a crowd of business leaders at Dubuque Regional Airport on Wednesday afternoon, an announcement for flight passengers interrupted him over the loudspeaker. "Don't you love that sound?" he said with a laugh. Avilo Airlines' first flight to Dubuque Regional Airport landed Wednesday afternoon, with the Dubuque Area Chamber of Commerce ribbon-cutting to mark the occasion. The inbound flight held 160 passengers, and the outgoing flight was booked with 163 passengers. Avilo will provide service between Dubuque and Orlando International Airport on Wednesdays and Saturdays on a Boeing 737 aircraft, which can hold as many as 189 passengers. "We're super excited to welcome Avilo to the tri-state area," Airport Director Todd Dalsing told the Telegraph Herald. "This isn't just about Dubuque. It's about everyone within our 40-mile radius." Avilo arrival marks the return of commercial air service to Dubuque Regional Airport after American Airlines stopped service in September. Officials announced in November Avilo's plans to offer flights between Dubuque and Orlando, Florida. Avilo flights from Orlando to Dubuque Regional Airport will land about 5:05 p.m. Wednesdays and Saturdays, with flights taking off to Orlando at 5:50 p.m. Avilo Airlines initially planned to begin offering air service out of Dubuque Airport January 11th. However, the flight was canceled after the airport did not secure Transportation Security Administration approval of a complete security plan. In the interim, Avilo operated its planned Dubuque flights out of Eastern Iowa Airport in Cedar Rapids. "Customers had vacation plans already booked, but we were able to provide alternative service and accommodate those customers," Dalsing said. "And while we were waiting for Avilo here, people still flew and booked Avilo." Courtney Goff, communications manager for Avilo Airlines, said charter buses to Cedar Rapids were being offered to passengers who initially flew out of Cedar Rapids and now are landing in Dubuque. She said the need for those buses should be gone by next week. "The bookings were so good that we didn't want to leave people high and dry," she said. "Even though there was a little bit of an inconvenience, we wanted to show that we are committed to this area. We're not going to announce and leave." Dubuque Airport officials confirmed earlier this month that they had obtained the needed TSA approval and that flights were ready to begin Wednesday. "We had to wait a little longer than we wanted, but we're here now," Kavanaugh said during the ribbon cutting. "We're here now and we're not stopping. I'm excited to say hello, Avilo, and welcome to Dubuque." Dalsing said he and Dubuque Chamber President and CEO Molly Grover first heard about Avilo Airlines in March 2022 while attending an air service conference. He said a true market study found that roughly 27,000 people within a 40-mile radius of Dubuque fly to Orlando each year. With Avilo flying from Dubuque, about 20,000 people can now make that trek annually, he said. "We knew there was a market to go there, and we will continue to build that market to meet customer demand," he said. Goff said she didn't have an exact booking numbers for flights going forward, but numbers still were strong for tickets, which start as low as $49 one way. She said the first day Dubuque flights initially went on sale was one of the big sales days in our history. "The biggest things that we try to offer to our customers are low fares and convenient flights," she said. "We always try to get at least one of those for our customers. Dubuque aligned both of these things." Dalsing noted that the start of Avilo flights will have a positive economic impact on the community, including jobs to assist with flights and provide service to customers in the airport. He said Avilo flights also open up the opportunity for the airport to look into other markets for future destinations, depending upon where demand is located. Grover said the start of Avilo air service is an economic asset to the entire area, and the flights will also have an asset as work continues to bring additional commercial air service to Dubuque Regional Airport. "It's a great day and a huge step forward as we continue to advance our air service," she said. "Business begets business. Success breeds success. There are a lot of efforts to ensure that. Dubuque County Supervisor Harley Potthoff also expressed excitement for Avilo's arrival during Wednesday's event, thanking all the people involved who brought commercial flights back to Dubuque. "It was under a year ago that we found out we were going to lose our air service," he said. "Less than 6 months ago, we did lose our air service, and here we are now, starting over." City residents impassioned to rename park. Dubuque panel mulls list of names to replace Pigorsk Park by John Cruz. Impassioned residents made the case for their preferred new names for a city park during a Dubuque Parks and Recreation Commission meeting this week. About 20 people turned out to the meeting, at which commission members discussed making a recommendation of a new name for the parcel formerly known as Pigorsk Park. The commission ultimately voted to table making a recommendation until its meeting on April 11th. Whichever name members recommend will require final approval by the Dubuque City Council. The park, located at 16th Street and Kerper Boulevard, previously was named in honor of the Dubuque's former sister city, Pigorsk, Russia. In July, the city sister city committee of travel Dubuque agreed to suspend the sister city status with Pigorsk, citing Russia's invasion of Ukraine. In August, city council members agreed to remove any signage relating to Pigorsk and directed city staff to determine a process for renaming the park. City and staff invited residents to submit their own suggestions for renaming the park. More than 100 submissions were received. Ahead of this week's meeting, the Parks and Recreation Commission already had narrowed the list down to 7 possible names to recommend to Dubuque City Council. The 7 names are Matthew Spots Park, for the Dubuque native and U.S. Army sergeant who was killed in action during World War I. Ted Ellsworth Park, for the Dubuque native who joined the British Army in World War II before the U.S. joined the fighting, then later transferred to the U.S. Army. Gordon Kilgore Park, for the longtime Dubuque radio news director posthumously inducted into the Iowa Broadcast Association's Hall of Fame. Sister Carolyn Farrell Park, named for Dubuque's first female city council member and the city's only female mayor, who held the latter post in 1980. J.C.'s Park and Trail, Kerper Wiverock Park, Nathaniel Morgan Park, for a black man who was lynched by a white mob in Dubuque in 1840. He and his wife Charlotte were among the first settlers in Dubuque in the 1830s. About half of the meeting attendees wore colored stickers with Ted Ellsworth Park printed on them to support the World War II veteran, who later served 2 terms in the Iowa House of Representatives. Dubuque resident Jack Wurzberger said Ellsworth was one-of-a-kind local resident who deserved to be honored by the city. "Ted was the most decorated combat soldier in Dubuque's history since the Civil War," Wurzberger said. "I ask that every consideration be given to naming the park after Ted." Dubuque resident Michael Spots asked commission members to name the park after his great-uncle, Matthew Spots. For his service in France, Matthew Spots was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross, the second highest military decoration awarded by the U.S. Army. "He gave his life so that liberty and freedom could live," Michael Spots said. "I hope he can make this happen for him by naming the park in his honor." One attendee spoke in favor of the name J.C.'s Park and Trail. Another noted her support for naming the park for Sister Carolyn Farrell. One resident spoke in favor of a park name that wasn't among the list of finalists. Kevin Firmstall, chair of the Sister City Committee, urged commission members to recommend the park be named Sister City Park to maintain the park's original purpose of promoting the Sister City program. Fernstall said he felt the Sister City Committee should have been given more input on how the park should be renamed. "I also want to express my disappointment that the Sister City Committee was not advised or counseled on this project," Fernstall said. "We had some input that might have been valuable at the time." Commission Chair Jennifer Tigges said the cases made by the residents were insightful, but she stressed that the renaming of the park is not a popularity contest. "There are a lot of criteria that we have to look at," Tigges said. We are going to pick what we feel best fits that criteria. Commission members agreed that whichever name is chosen will be picked from a list of exceptional options. I think all the submissions are fantastic, said Commissioner Member Ron Axtell. Unfortunately, we only have one pick. The final front page article is entitled Lancaster Settling Excessive Force Lawsuit for $72,000. The settlement is tied to an incident in 2021 involving an officer and a woman being booked into the county jail by Grace Neeland. Lancaster, Wisconsin. Lancaster City officials are settling a lawsuit that claimed a police officer used excessive force during a 2021 incident at the local jail. Once all parties sign the agreement, complainant Kara Kittleson will receive $72,500 under the terms of the settlement to be paid out by the city's liability insurer, Continental Western Insurance Company. Kittleson filed the lawsuit in June after a November 2021 incident in which she alleged Lancaster police officer Matthew Haverland used excessive force when booking her into the Grant County Jail, resulting in physical and emotional injuries. City Council members this week approved the settlement 7-0, with member Sarah Burks absent. The agreement states it is not an admission of wrongdoing on the part of the city or the officer, but that it was approved to avoid the expense of further litigation between the parties. Kittleson's lawyer, Paul Kinney, confirmed that the parties had come to agreement, but declined to comment further. A call from the Telegraph Herald to the firm representing the city was not returned. Court documents and police reports provided more information on the alleged incident. Kittleson's complaint states that she was being booked into the Grant County Jail on November 30, 2021. Online court records state that she had been arrested on charges of disorderly conduct and misdemeanor battery domestic abuse in connection with an incident at her Lancaster home. She was also charged with resisting or obstructing an officer in connection with the incident at the jail. Kittleson later entered a no-contest plea and was found guilty of disorderly conduct domestic abuse in February 2022. The other charges were dismissed on a motion by the prosecution. The complaint states that Kittleson was standing at the jail desk in handcuffs waiting for booking when Haverland allegedly threw Kittleson to the floor face first. Documents state that she later awoke in a pool of her own blood. Because Kittleson was handcuffed, she had no way to break her fall, court documents state. Her face hit the hard floor, knocking her unconscious, breaking several teeth and causing other injuries. A police report provided by Police Chief Deborah Rukoff states that officers called EMS for Kittleson's injuries and she was transported to Grant Regional Health Center for stitches. Kittleson lost and regained consciousness multiple times before EMS arrived, but she never stopped breathing. A second police report, penned by Haverland, states that prior to the incident, Kittleson had kicked him in an attempt and attempted to headbutt him multiple times and started to thrash around when he attempted to subdue her. At one point, she hit the radio microphone on Haverland's shoulder, which then struck his chin. At the time, Haverland wrote that he believed it was Kittleson's head that had hit him. It was at this time that I decentralized Kara and took her to the ground, Haverland wrote in the report. When Kara was directed to the ground, her head and upper torso made contact with the concrete floor. The incident was also captured on the body camera of an officer who assisted with the initial arrest. That footage shows Kittleson attempting to headbutt Haverland before he takes her to the ground, according to a police report. EMS was called immediately after the incident, and Haverland reported the use of force to a superior. Both Haverland and the city of Lancaster were listed as defendants in the case. The complaint alleged that Haverland's actions exhibited use of excessive force in violation of a state law. It also states the city policies allowed for such actions, which is why the city also was listed as a defendant. Lancaster had policies in place whereby its officers were trained that it was acceptable to throw a handcuffed person to the floor face first as a use of force, the lawsuit states. The complaint alleges that Kittleson's complaint was not the first time something similar had happened in Lancaster, though it did not provide any information on those occurrences, and Rukoff said she was not aware of any similar incidences. The department's use of force policy, which last was updated on June of 2021, states, "Officers shall use only the level of force that reasonably appears necessary to effectively bring an incident under control." Haverland still is employed at the department, and Rukoff said in an email that he was counseled after the incident, though he was never put on leave. She added that officers receive yearly training on the use of force, which includes reviewing department policy and practice scenarios. When reached directly, Haverland directed all comments to Rukoff. Attempts to reach Kittleson directly were unsuccessful. The settlement will take effect once all parties have signed the agreement. News in brief. Police. Dubuque man assaulted another, causing brain injury. Police said a Dubuque man was arrested for an assault that caused another man to suffer a brain injury. Kasai A. Roach, age 20, of 1160 West 3rd Street, was arrested at 5:40 a.m. Wednesday at Dubuque Law Enforcement Center on a warrant charging willful injury causing serious injury. Court documents state that police were dispatched at about 8:42 p.m. Friday to Superstop 4, 535 Hill Street, for a report of an assault. Police found Leonard T. Camacho, 27, no permanent address, in a vehicle bleeding from the face. Camacho was transported by ambulance to Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center, where doctors advised that he would require transfer to University of Iowa hospitals and clinics for treatment of a brain bleed. Investigators determined that Roach and Camacho had argued about a parking issue while they were getting gas at the convenience store, documents state. Roach told police that he had punched Camacho in the face, which knocked him to the ground, documents state. Roach said he had acted in self-defense, then left the scene. Another police notice, Dubuque man sexually abused girl multiple times. Police said a Dubuque man sexually assaulted a girl under the age of 17 multiple times during the course of a decade. Armand Cattell, 40, of 928 Garfield Avenue, was arrested at 12:29 p.m. Tuesday at Dubuque Law Enforcement Center on a warrant charging third-degree sexual abuse. Court documents state that the girl told authorities that Cattell, whom she knew, began sexually assaulting her about 10 years ago out of state. The girl said the abuse later continued in Dubuque. The latest sexual assault occurred this year. DEI panel discussion focuses on safe local neighborhoods. Dubuque Police Chief and others reject the perception that some areas in the city are dogged by street crime. Article submitted by Joshua Irvin. Panelists at a community conservation held Wednesday at Steeple Square in Dubuque discussed ways to help residents feel safe in the community. The panel was the latest in a series sponsored by TH Media and Community Foundation of Greater Dubuque. While the discussion opened with Dubuque's crime statistics, discussion showed the question of safety went farther and wider than crime. That was in part because Dubuque generally is a safe community, panelists said. U.S. Census data showed the city's violent crime rate climbed from 2014 to 2021. From 2.26 to 3.69 incidents per 1,000 people. However, it was below the rates in larger cities such as Davenport, Des Moines, Sioux City, and Waterloo, and it fell in line with the general rise in violent crime nationwide. Alex Baum of the Community Foundation pointed out that very little of that crime resulted from random acts. The vast majority of violent crimes committed in 2021 were committed by someone who was known to their victim, Brown noted. Much of the evening's discussion pushed back against the idea that Dubuque, particularly its downtown, is dogged by street crime. Police Chief Jeremy Jensen was among the most vocal critics of that perception, saying crime hotspots downtown corresponded with high-density areas. "I have no place in Dubuque I'm afraid to go," he said. "I have no place I'm afraid for my daughters to go." The question of safe neighborhoods, then, became a matter of how to make residents feel safe, particularly for people who are marginalized. Lori Olendek, a disability advocate, pointed to the need for more physically inclusive spaces, while Enoch Sanchez, an insurance agent and Latinx community leader, said more grocery store options downtown could reduce poverty crime by providing more affordable food options to low-income residents. Jensen also answered written questions from audience members about local racial disparities in the crime justice system. While the disparity between black and white offenders charged in Dubuque has improved from 2014 to 2021, black residents were still more than 16 times more likely to be arrested and charged with a violent crime, and 9 times as likely to be charged with a drug or narcotics violation. The latter figure was the highest disparity among Iowa's major cities. Jensen said he cringed looking at the numbers. A consensus area among panelists was that the best way to improve perceptions of safety was for residents to make a point of meeting their neighbors. Sanchez said the onus for that fell on longtime residents and was as simple as showing up to events such as Latinx Fiesta. Just showing that mutual respect of, hey, I'm not 100% about you, but I'm here to learn. That mutual respect would go a tremendous distance, Sanchez said. Our next article is entitled, Dubuque Budgets $150,000 to Reduce Odors at Treatment Plant, and it's submitted by John Cruz. The city of Dubuque plans to spend $150,000 next fiscal year to reduce odors emanating from its wastewater treatment plant. In the proposed budget for fiscal year 2024, which begins on July 1st, the Dubuque Water and Resource Recovery Center intends to use the funds to install an odor and struvite control system. During a budget hearing on Tuesday, plant manager William O'Brien told Dubuque City Council that the project should help to reduce the foul smells coming from the facility. O'Brien said the equipment the city would purchase would primarily be used to inject and mix iron salts into sludge tanks, and the salts would bind sulfur compounds that emit odorous gases when they break down. The city is in the midst of implementing a pilot project to use chemical injections at the wastewater treatment plant to reduce odors. Initially, the city had chosen to use hydrogen peroxide, but it has now chosen to utilize iron salts. The city hopes to eventually construct a $3 to $5 million improved high-strength waste receiving and handling facility, which will significantly reduce odors. That project is not expected to begin until the fall. City Council members Susan Farber and Kathy Wethall commended the city's efforts to solve the odor issue and urged that the problem be dealt with soon. We're hoping to truly abate some of that odor on behalf of the residents, Farber said. The City Council must give final approval for its fiscal year 2024 budget by the end of April. A breakdown of department budgets presented on Tuesday is as follows. Information Services, revenue or resources projected $756,465. Expenditures projected $2,187,785. Expense change from fiscal year 2022, a 6.7% increase. Tax support requested $1,431,320. Tax support current year $1,438,059. Employment change. Moved a law enforcement user support specialist position from the police department to information services, resulting in the total equivalent of 13 full-time employees. Recommended improvement packages, $16,000 to install an additional core switch to the city's network, $4,000 to purchase security software and tools to conduct monthly scans of city technology for security purposes, $1,200 to provide an online course-based learning system specifically geared to advanced technical training, and $8,490 to have 3 staff members attend the 2024 Annual User and Education Conference for the new Tyler software, and $4,000 to replace 5 projectors. Now we turn to the opinion section. Local newspapers help communities in Iowa thrive, by Doug Burns. What separates average to good Iowa towns from thriving ones, former Governor Terry Branstad often said, is the presence of locally owned banks and a dedicated community newspaper. Community newspapers are a big part of what makes Iowa, well, Iowa. And that's why it's so troubling that some in the Iowa Senate are considering requiring legal notices to be posted on some to-be-created state-run website and would not be required to be published in a local newspaper. Senate File 546 would, in practical terms, eliminate an essential part of your newspaper, limiting the news, and in so doing, cripple many newspapers, many of which are already facing financial struggles. In an age where reality is in rare supply and social media feeds ugliness and division, Iowa's community newspapers serve as something of a last bastion of collective truth. Readers are close to the local news, so they either know stories to be true and accurate, or if they doubt, they can easily find the reporters and owners. Of Iowa's 240 newspapers, 80% are privately owned. More than 100 Iowa newspapers have fewer than 1,000 subscribers. What these newspapers print is local, local, local. It's stories on eight-man football and city council proceedings, celebrations of new business openings, and the solemn and sacred responsibility, what I always considered the soul of the newspaper, the timely and careful collection and publishing of obituaries. The newspapers of Iowa are generally practical, not ideological. Most small-town newspaper owners are busy running from the Rotary meeting for a photo to the high school for a story and later to the council meetings. They have no time to weigh in with views on national and state government. Some do, yes, but the vast majority of papers keep it local. A big part of newspapers, public notices, local ones, information on how your small town is spending money, what the schools and counties in your area are doing, are best presented in newspaper as the content is relevant and easily accessible. Unlike the California-based social media Goliaths with deep tentacles into our lives, newspapers are responsible for their content. Facebook and Twitter are considered platforms and are not liable for anything users post. We correct our mistakes in the newspaper business, and if errors are damaging enough, aggrieved parties can seek remedies in Iowa district courts. Ever try getting a correction on Facebook? The most distressing unintended consequence of these detailed public records not being printed in your local newspaper will be more division in Iowa, and if you can imagine, an ever more ugly politics as fallen newspapers and the people who care about the community first leave a content void that big dollar donors and from the coast will be all too happy to fill with ideological oriented news sites, with writers who are more scalp hunters for Republicans and Democrats than reporters. Many local newspapers, the sources Branstad always knew as central to economic and community development, are dutiful in running columns from their local legislators, mostly Republicans in rural Iowa. The legislators can relate items of local interest, which is essential. In the absence of newspapers, which will result in many areas of Iowa of Senate File 546, the even-handed, trusted local folks at the paper will be quickly replaced by purveyors of political distortion. Our state needs its community newspapers and reliable, accessible public notices. Without them, Iowa won't know what they don't know. A letter to the editor. A good leader makes things better for citizens. Submitted by Stephen Grutzmacher. I am 69 years old, looking forward toward a grim 70th as my savings over the past 2 years have dwindled due to excessive government spending. You can say one thing about President Trump. He made me money. My IRA was cruising right along, and I was looking toward a nice nest egg. Then Bidenflation hit, and I think if I took my money out and put it under my mattress, I would have been better off. Now, hopefully, President Trump will return and things will turn around for the better. Ron DeSantis is a good moneymaker as well. You know, the Donald is a very self-absorbed individual. He wishes we could all see his face when we look in the mirror, like he does. He's conceited, arrogant, immature at times, but I'm not looking for a nice guy as president. I want my life to improve, and Donald made that happen. I don't care if he wears ladies' undergarments and kisses his picture before he goes to sleep. He makes things better, and that's what I want in a leader. Right before the obituaries, we'll pause to remind you were listening to the Telegraph Herald on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Bob. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, give us a call at 515-243-6833. And now we return to the obituaries. Helena Fleming. Helena Fleming died peacefully in hospice care March 22, 2023, at age 96. Helena Eason Greenhill was born in Seattle, Washington, on July 22, 1926, to James Eason and Christina Ford Greenhill. She had one older sister, Jessie. She graduated from Queen Anne High School and attended Seattle Pacific College. The Greenhills were recent Scottish immigrants for whom the focus of family life was their church fellowship, comprising many European immigrants like themselves. Among them was Kenneth Fleming, whose English immigrant family also lived on Queen Anne Hill. Services will be held at Arbor Oaks Bible Chapel, JFK Road, Dubuque, on Saturday, March 25th. Viewing is 11:30 a.m. The service will begin at 1:30, following immediately by burial service at Asbury Methodist Cemetery, Asbury Road. A reception will follow back at the church. Memorials in lieu of flowers may be designated to the Kenneth C. Fleming Intercultural Studies Award at Emmaus Bible College. David J. Oldenburg of Galena, Illinois. David J. Oldenburg, 73, of Galena, Illinois, passed away on Monday, March 20th, 2023, at his home surrounded by his family. A mass of Christian burial will be held at 11 a.m. Monday, March 27, 2023, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Galena, where friends may call after 10 a.m. until the time of Mass. Friends may call from 1 to 4 p.m. Sunday, March 26, 2023, at Furlong Funeral Chapel in Galena. A parish rosary will be recited at noon at the funeral home. The burial will be in the church cemetery. Military honors will be accorded graveside by Galena VFW Post 2665 and American Legion Post number 193. David was born on April 3, 1949, in Hazel Green, Wisconsin, the son of Leo and Rose Mans Oldenburg. He married Margaret Maggie Piquette on April 16, 1977, at St. Michael's Catholic Church in Galena. Cecilia H. Hirsch, 96, of Dubuque, died on Monday, March 20, 2023. Visitation will be held from 9 to 10:45 Monday, March 27th, at Sacred Heart Catholic Church, where services will follow at 11 a.m. Burial will take place in Mount Calvary Cemetery. Bear Funeral Home, 1491 Main Street, is assisting the family. Marilyn Kafer, 78, of Dubuque, died on Monday, March 20th, 2023. Visitation will be held from 9:15 to 10:15 Monday, March 27th, at Church of the Resurrection, where a mass of Christian burial will follow at 10:30 a.m. Burial will take place in Mount Calvary Cemetery. Eaglehoff Siegert and Casper Westview Funeral Home and Cremation, 2569 John F. Kennedy Road, is assisting the family. Charlene Hawks, 93, of Dubuque, died on Tuesday, March 21, 2023. Visitation will be held from 3 to 7 p.m. Friday, March 31, at Eaglehoff Siegert and Casper Funeral Home, 2659 John F. Kennedy Road. A mass of Christian burial will take place at 11 a.m. Saturday, April 1, at Resurrection Catholic Church. Anne M. Schreck, 93, of Platteville, died on Tuesday, March 21, 2023. Visitation will be held from 10 to 11 a.m. Saturday, March 25th, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Platteville, where a mass of Christian burial will follow. Burial will take place in Calvary Cemetery in Platteville. Melby Funeral Home and Crematory of Platteville is assisting the family. Raymond A. Young, 77, of Galena, died on Thursday, March 16, 2023. Arrangements are pending. Furlong Funeral Chapel of Galena is assisting the family. Harold E. Skase of Elizabeth, Illinois, was 77 at the time of his death on March 20, 2023. Graveside services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, March 25th, at Elmwood Cemetery in Warren. Law Jones Funeral Home of Elizabeth is assisting the family. Diane Rondeau, 70, of Dubuque, died on Tuesday, March 21, 2023. Visitation will be held from 1 to 3 p.m. Saturday, March 25th at Summit Congregational Church, where services will follow. Eaglehoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory, 2569 John F. Kennedy Road, is assisting the family. The following is listed as funeral services. Mary A. Benke, Dubuque. Prayer service at 4 p.m., followed by visitation until 7 p.m. today. Hoffmanschneider and Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory, 3860 Asbury Road. Mass of Christian Burial, 10:30 a.m. Friday, March 24th, Church of the Resurrection. Joseph P. Bierman, Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin. Visitation 4 to 7 p.m. today, and from 10 to 11 a.m. Friday, March 24th, at Garrity Funeral Home, Prairie du Chien. Mass of Christian Burial at 11 a.m. Friday, St. John's Catholic Church in Prairie du Chien. Robert E. Bischoff of Garnavello, Iowa. Visitation from 4 to 8 p.m. Friday, March 24th. Morris Funeral Home, Garnavello. Service 10:30 a.m. Saturday, March 25th at St. Peter's Lutheran Church in Garnavello. Leslie A. Blum, Schulzburg, Wisconsin. Celebration of Life, 1 to 4 p.m., Sunday, March 26, Centenary United Methodist Church in Schulzburg. Nellie N. Bosek, Prairie du Chien. Visitation, 10 a.m. to noon, Monday, March 27, Thornburg Grau Funeral Home, Prairie du Chien. Service, noon, Monday at the funeral home. Mary P. Grebe, Galena, Illinois. Visitation 10 to 11 a.m. Saturday, March 25th at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Galena. Service 11 a.m. Saturday at the church. Joshua Holtz, Manchester, Iowa. Celebration of Life 2 to 5 p.m. Saturday, March 25th, Delaware County Community Center, Manchester. Virginia Kotke, Prairie du Chien, Wisconsin. 11 a.m. Saturday, March 25th, Bible Baptist Church, Prairie du Chien. Velma E. Masbrook, Platteville, Wisconsin. Visitation, 12:30 to 2 p.m. Friday, March 24th, Lutheran Church of Peace in Platteville. Service, 2 p.m. Friday at the church. Donna M. Metzger of Garber, Iowa. Visitation, 10 to 11 a.m. Friday, March 24th, Leonard Miller Funeral Home, Edgewood. Service, 11 a.m. Friday at the funeral home. Judith F. Meyer, Dubuque. Celebrations of Life, 2 p.m. Saturday, March 25th. Catfish Charlie's. Irvin M. Nauman, Altoona, Iowa. Visitation, 9 to 10:30 a.m. Saturday, March 25th at St. Anthony's Catholic Church. Mass of Christian Burial, 10:30 a.m. Saturday at the church. Henry C. Noltin, Preston, Iowa. Visitation, 9:30 to 11 a.m., Saturday, March 25th, Green Island Congregational Church, Miles. Service, 11 a.m., Saturday at the church. Dennis R. Pickle, Dubuque. Visitation, 9 to 11 a.m., Monday, March 27th, St. Patrick's Catholic Church. Mass of Christian Burial, 11 a.m., March 27th at the church. Judith A. Schaefer, visitation 9 to 10:45 p.m., Saturday, March 25th, St. Joseph the Worker Catholic Church. Mass of Christian Burial, 11 a.m., Saturday at the church. Roger Stoddard, Savannah, Illinois, Memorial Gathering, 10 to 11 a.m., Saturday, March 25th, Law Jones Funeral Home, Savannah. Service, 11 a.m., Saturday, at the funeral home. Deborah Tepperly, East Dubuque, Illinois. Visitation, 4 to 7 p.m., Friday, March 24th, Miller Funeral Home, East Dubuque. And from 9:15 to 9:45 a.m., Saturday, March 25th, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in East Dubuque. Service, 10 a.m., Saturday, at the church. Joseph R. Veach, Otter Creek, Iowa. Wake service, 3:45 p.m., Friday, March 24th. Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road. Visitation, 4 to 7 p.m. Friday at the funeral home. Coletta C. Wegman, Bloomington, Wisconsin. Visitation 1 to 3 p.m. Saturday, March 25th, Route 35, Pub and Pizza in Bloomington. Carolyn M. Welsh, Dubuque. Wake service 3:45 p.m. Friday, March 24th, Bear Funeral Home, 1491 Main Street. Celebration of Life, 4 to 7 p.m. Friday at the Funeral Home. Service, 10:30 a.m. Saturday, March 25th, Holy Ghost Catholic Church. That concludes our obituaries for today, and now we'll turn to sports. Packed with power, all-area team loaded with state qualifiers, conference champs. By Tim O'Neill. Girls wrestling wrestling is on the rise across the nation, and the tri-state area is no different. 25 area wrestlers qualified for their respective state tournaments, and 5 came away with medals. Here is the 4th annual Telegraph Herald All-Area Girls Wrestling Team, with 18 wrestlers selected to the first team based on overall season record and state tournament finish. Lower weights, 100 to 145 pounds. Grace Murphy, Western Dubuque. Murphy went 25-13 and qualified for the Iowa State Tournament at 100 pounds. Hannah Real, Dubuque Senior. Real posted a 25-14 record this season, won a Mississippi Valley Conference Championship, and placed 7th at 115 pounds at the Iowa State Tournament. Real is a 3-time first-team selection and is just the second area wrestler to earn a spot on 3 Telegraph Herald All-Area Girls Wrestling Teams and medal at 3 state tournaments, joining Dubuque Wallert's Alana Duggan. Avia Ball, Lancaster. Ball went 13-5 and qualified for the Wisconsin State Tournament at 120 pounds. Ava McDermott, Dubuque Wallert. McDermott went 24-9 and qualified for the Iowa State Tournament at 120 pounds. She earned honorable mention in 2021. Odessa Liebfried, Bellevue. Liebfried went 32-8 this season and placed 6th at 125 pounds at the Iowa State Tournament. Kylie Shoup, West Delaware. Shoup went 33-8 this year and qualified for the Iowa State Tournament at 130 pounds. Isla Osterkamp, Dubuque, Hempstead. Osterkamp went 19-12 this season, won a Mississippi Valley Conference Championship, and qualified for the Iowa State Tournament at 135 pounds. Chloe LaRue, Cuba City, Benton, Southwestern. LaRue went 24-2 this season and finished runner-up at 145 pounds at the Wisconsin State Tournament. She was also a first-team selection last year. Jolie Strohmeyer, Dubuque Senior. Strohmeyer went 24-14 this season, won a Mississippi Valley Conference Championship, and qualified for the Iowa State Tournament at 145 pounds. Now in the upper weights, from 155 to 235 pounds. Josie Jeklin, Western Dubuque. Jeklin went 26-7 and placed 8th at 155 pounds at the Iowa State Tournament. An original member of the Bobcats program, she was a first-team selection last year and earned honorable mention in 2021. Paige Howison, Dubuque, Hempstead. Howison went 16-7 this season and qualified for the Iowa State Tournament at 155 pounds. Leah Schwenker from Cascade. Schwenker went 32-10 and qualified for the Iowa State Tournament at 155 pounds. Rachel Schauer of Fenimore. Schauer went 10-3 and finished at the 165-pound runner-up at this Wisconsin State Tournament. She was also a first-team selection last year. Avery Schmidt, Dubuque Wallert. Schmidt won 14 of her 20 matches this season and qualified for the Iowa State Tournament at 170 pounds. Lydia Hafel, Dubuque Hempstead. Hafel went 18-9 this season and qualified for the Iowa State Tournament at 190 pounds. Sheridan Engelking, Western Dubuque. Engelking went 30-9 this season and qualified for the Iowa State Tournament at 190 pounds. She earned honorable mention last season. Adriana Shepherd, Western Dubuque. Shepherd went 25-8 this season, won a Mississippi Valley Conference Championship, and qualified for the Iowa State Tournament at 235 pounds. Caitlin Brokus, Dubuque Hempstead. Brokaw's posted a 21-8 record this season and qualified for the Iowa State tournament at 235 pounds. Honorable mention from Bellevue, Ryan Dunn at 140 pounds. Cascade, Belay Martin and Helena Reed. Martin at 170 pounds, Reed at 235 pounds. Dubuque Senior, Kennedy Stolk, 110 pounds. From Lancaster, Kalashia Willis, Weist at 138 pounds. At West Delaware, Anna O'Rear at 120 pounds. And out of Western Dubuque, Kaya Steger at 145 pounds. In baseball news, Major League Baseball alters clock rules. Commissioner's office listens to player input before the tweaks. From Ronald Bloom out of New York. Major League Baseball has clarified its new rules to allow umpires to delay the start of a pitch clock after big swings in which a hitter loses footing or when a pitcher covers first base, third, or home, in addition to other clarifications announced Wednesday. The commissioner's office said in its memo that if a catcher ends an inning on base, at bat, or on deck, an umpire may determine the catcher needs additional time and allow the pitcher another warm-up throw and the catcher to throw to second base. The MLB also said whether a defensive team violated the new shift restrictions will be subject to a video review only involving the first player to touch a ball after a pitch. The league also said that after the batter uses his once-allowed timeout during a plate appearance, the clock shall start when the batter indicates he is ready, in addition to the previous specification when he returns to the batter's box. The clarifications ahead of March 30th openers were contained in a four-page memo sent by Major League Baseball Senior Vice President Michael Hill to managers, general managers, and assistant general managers, a copy of which was obtained by the Associated Press. They're important in my mind because they're responsive to things players said to us, Commissioner Rob Manfred said Tuesday night before Japan beat the United States 3-2 in the World Baseball Classic Championship game in Miami. Baseball's 11-man competition committee, established in the labor agreement last March, adopted the pitch clock and shift limits last September over the opposition of the four players in the panel. Major League Baseball set the pitch clock at 15 seconds with no runners and 20 seconds with runners. The average time of spring training games through Monday was down 25 minutes to 2 hours and 36 minutes. Violations per game were 1.03 during the past week, down from 2.03 during spring training's first week, according to the memo. Teams were told bat boys and girls in the visiting dugout will meet with the visiting club before each series to discuss the player preferences. Major League Baseball said it will monitor the bat boys and girls to determine whether they contribute to noncompliance with the pace of game procedures. Major League Baseball said it will issue guidance to teams Friday on use of PitchCom by pitchers. Catchers were allowed to use the device to call pitches last season, and pitchers were allowed to experiment with it during spring training. In other local area sports, Duhok spiked past Augustana in three sets. The Loras men's volleyball team etched its third consecutive victory with a 25-13, 25-16, 25-22 straight set win over Augustana on Wednesday in Rock Island, Illinois. Dorian Fiorenza downed 12 kills, while John Horn dished out 32 assists and provided 7 digs. In men's lacrosse, Clark 13, Monmouth 11. At Burroughs Field, Connor Cole scored 6 times to lead the Pride past Monmouth. Dubuque 16, Augustana 6. At Oyen Field, Ben Faraday and Giovanni Silva scored 4 times each to spark the Spartans. College softball, Platteville 6, Colby 5. At Winter Haven, Florida, Peyton Marvin had 3 hits to help the Pioneers pass Colby. In prep baseball, Warren Stockton 4, Forreston 3. At Forreston, Illinois, Beatty Brohaus went 2-for-4 and delivered a 2-out game-winning double in the 8th to propel the Warhawks over Forreston on Tuesday. In prep track and field, Comets 3rd. At A.Y. McDonald Track, Riley Carrier won the 55 hurdles in 8:08, and Bellevue won the distance medley relay in 3:50.64 to claim third place with 64 points in the River Valley Conference Indoor Championship hosted by the University of Dubuque on Tuesday. Taylor Wing won the 55 dash in 7.39 and long jump as Makokita placed third in the girls' standings. Devin Simon won the 55 hurdles and anchored the winning 4x400 relay of 4:17.69 for Cascade. And now we'll turn to business news. The Dow Industrial finished yesterday down 530.49. The NASDAQ finished down 190.15. S&P was down 65.90. The final tally for the Dow was set at 32,030.11. The NASDAQ was 11,669.96, and the S&P was at 3936.97. The 10-year T-bill is at 3.45, down 0.16. The 30-year T-bond is at 3.67, down 0.06. Fed raises key interest rates despite bank turmoil. The Federal Reserve extends its year-long fight against high inflation by raising its key interest rate a quarter point. Out of Washington, the Federal Reserve extended its year-long fight against high inflation Wednesday by raising its key interest rate by a quarter point, despite concerns that higher borrowing rates could worsen the turmoil that has gripped the banking system. "The U.S. banking system is sound and resilient," the Fed said in a statement after its latest policy meeting. At the same time, the Fed warned that the upheaval stemming from the fall of two major banks is likely to result in tighter credit conditions and weigh on economic activity, hiring, and inflation. The central bank also signaled that it's likely nearing the end of its aggressive streak of rate hikes. In its statement, it removed language that it previously said it would keep raising rates at future meetings. The statement now says some additional policy firming may be appropriate, a weaker comment to future hikes. In its latest quarterly projections, the policymakers forecast that they expect to raise their key rate just once more, from its new level of about 4.9% to 5.1%, the same peak they projected in December. Still, the Fed statement included some language and indicated that its inflation fight remains far from complete. It noted that inflation remains elevated, and it removed a phrase, "inflation has eased somewhat," that was in the statement in February. Speaking at a news conference, Chairman Jerome Powell said, "The process of getting inflation back down to 2% has a long way to go and is likely to be bumpy." Despite the Fed's projection that it will impose only one more rate hike, Powell said the central bank may still choose to carry out additional hikes if inflation remains chronically high. Powell acknowledged that some banks may reduce their pace of lending at a time of high anxiety in the financial system. Any such pullback in lending, he said, could slow the economy and possibly act as the equivalent of an additional quarter point rate hike. Events in the banking system over the past 2 weeks are likely to result in tighter credit conditions for households and businesses, the Fed chair said. It is too soon to determine the extent of these effects, and therefore too soon for the Fed to know how or whether plans for interest rates might be affected. Wednesday's rate hike, the Fed's ninth since last March, suggested that Powell is confident that the Fed can manage a dual challenge, cool still high inflation through higher loan rates, while diffusing turmoil in the banking sector through emergency lending programs and the Biden administration's decision to cover uninsured deposits at the two failed banks. The Fed signal that the end of its rate hiking campaign is in sight may also soothe financial markets as they digest the consequences of the banking turmoil and the takeover last weekend of Credit Suisse by its larger rival, UBS. Press at his news conference about the Fed's missing what observers say were clear signs that Silicon Valley Bank was at high risk of collapsing into the second largest bank failure in U.S. history, Powell acknowledged that we do need to strengthen supervision and regulation. But he declared that the overall banking system secure, saying, "These are not weaknesses, that they are at all broadly through the system." With Wednesday's hike, the Fed's benchmark short-term rate has reached its highest level in 16 years. The new level will likely lead to higher costs for many loans, from mortgages and auto purchases to credit cards and corporate borrowing. The succession of Fed rate hikes has also heightened the risk of a recession. And that will be the end of our reading today of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. I'm your reader, Bob. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.